claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. And if I'm very, very lucky, James McCanny will be joining me. I want to begin with a few updates about the situation in Ukraine. It appears that the Russians are making great progress and that they are not going to launch an attack on this massive plant where there are supposed to be hundreds of civilians, which contradicts, of course, the idea that Russians are committing war crimes since they have the facilities surrounded. If they were disposed to commit war crimes, they could reduce it, pulverize it with several missiles, maybe only one. That means what we're being told already on its face cannot be possibly true. It turns out Russia is using unmanned helicopters to draw Ukrainian air forces. A very interesting development. Ukrainian troops claim they shot down a Russian heavy rotary wing drone by the British-made Starstreak missile systems. That is the most troubling method, that defensive technique the Ukrainians have been given by the British. Photos of the wreckage of what turned out to be an unmanned aerial system were blasted across social media. It showed the drone had been completely devastated, disintegrated, but it was still possible to identify the rotor and the tail boom, as well as a label matching the Ukrainian, the Russian drone target developed by the Technodiamecta, a Russian company. The system with an unmanned aerial vehicle is designed to simulate low-speed drones and helicopters when testing prototype and modernized weapons. It includes a helicopter-type unmanned aerial vehicle with a takeout weight of over 315 kilograms, a ground control station, ground support facilities for the complex, and other equipment. According to the developers, the UAV complex simulates the behavior of air targets, allowing you to test new weapons on conditions as close as possible to combat. So here we have a report. President Putin has ordered his military to ditch its plan to storm the Azovstal steel plant in the besieged city of Mariupol, where several thousand Ukrainian troops as well as civilians are encamped, opting instead to continue to seal off the facility via a blockade. Block off the industrial area so that a fly cannot pass through, Putin instructed his defense minister. Russia's desire to show significant successes in the war ahead of its victory day on May 9th could affect how quickly and forcefully they attempt to conduct military operations in the UK, observed the Ministry of Defense of the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, Ukraine has presented a plan to halt Russia's ability to finance its war with gas and oil revenue by restricting key sectors in the country like banking, energy, transport, and import-export operations. But that does not appear to have slowed down Russia at all. We also have a report that Russia is bombing Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, according to the mayor, under heavy bombardment. huge blast. The Russian Federation is furiously bombing the city, said Kharkov Mayor Ihor Trekhov on a televised address. Trekhov said a million people remain in the northeastern city, and about 30% of the pre-war population have fled, primarily women, children, and the elderly. We do have a video report there approaching what Ukraine's called a victory boulevard in Mariupol. Despite the Ukraine flag still up, the only place the Ukrainian forces are still holed up is the steel plant. Here we have a number of vehicles approaching. The so-called, it's close 5 p.m., and the Ukrainian forces have rejected the offer of a corridor to surrender. This is a main highway we're talking about, and we're seeing visually going down the highway. Now here we are in Estrakhala Street, a couple of kilometers from the steel plant itself. Here's a map showing the location. Hello, can you say this is Mariupol? Man, it's Mariupol. I'm a local resident. So what are you wishing for tall finish, for there to be peace? Back to the map. Graham, what's the situation, Mariupol soldier? It's basically okay. The Ukrainians should have surrendered. We've offered them this chance since the morning. And they don't want to surrender, it seems. How is the morale? Good. Fighting spirits. Why not? You already feel victory, of course. We will have victory. We're doing the right thing. General Chat with Shamil and Boba, both from Gorlovka, who've been fighting for 8 years already, dream of seeing all the Gorlovka area under DNR control. Well, there's more to the video, but we're going to finesse it for now. Something going on right here in the USA is disturbing me profoundly. Multiple large food processing and distribution plants in the U.S. have recently exploded or burned down. As food uncertainty lingers on the horizon, thanks to U.S. sanctions and government decimation of the economy over the past 2 years, another factor is contributing to the problem. Since the beginning of the year, there are several very large food processing facilities have exploded or burned to the ground across the United States. This week, a vegetable and nut processing facility in Dufour, Oregon, became engulfed in flames for unknown reasons. Lights flickered. They heard a pop, went up to check it out. There was a fire, according to a report made to Wasco County 911 records listed at the Wasco County Sheriff's Log. The independent distributor of natural, organic, and non-GMO foods, which employs around 150, burned to the ground. 1 week before that fire in Oregon, a massive fire brought down a meat processing plant in Conway, New Hampshire. After burning for 16 hours, multiple fire crews finally put up the fire at East Conway Beef and Pork. But the facility, again, is completely destroyed. That same week, in Salinas, California, a massive fire at the Taylor Farms processing facility led to the evacuation of residents as it burned for over 17 hours. Taylor Farms is a major agriculture company that processes and delivers many of the salad kits seen in grocery stores. The cause of this fire is currently under investigation. Just weeks before that, a massive fire engulfed a Walmart distribution center in Plainfield, Indiana. where over 1,000 employees ship food and other supplies all over the region. The fire destroyed the massive 1 million square foot operation. That same week, one of the largest food facilities of its kind in South Texas caught fire and burned to the ground. Prior to burning down, the Rio Fresh facility in San Juan, Texas grew, packed, and shipped a variety of Texas-grown items, including Texas 10-15 sweet onions, melons, greens, cabbage, and kale. The cause of the fire is currently unknown. And there's more. In Hermiston, Oregon, in February, a massive food processing facility suddenly exploded, injuring 7 of the nearly 400 employees who work at the Shearer's food plant. According to reports, the cause of the explosion, which originated near a boiler, is still under investigation. It's not only food production and distribution plants either. In Maricopa, Arizona, in March, a massive fire wiped out the Maricopa food pantry, which distributes food to the less fortunate. More than 50,000 pounds of food was destroyed in the blaze that lasted for 24 hours. That fire is also under investigation. The fact that since last year, more than a dozen of these fires and explosions have taken place at food processing and distribution plants is a source of grave concern. My opinion is that this is part and parcel of the Great Reset, which, of course, is constructed to wipe us out, not only by means of the mass, which are killing us slowly, but by means of the vax, which is killing us faster. And then, of course, in addition, we have starvation as the ultimate appeal. And I dare say it appears to be going on apace, as I've been reporting, as Mike Adams has been right on top of this. There's been a huge effort to undermine the possibility of agriculture, farming, planting foods. Fertilizer is being cut off. An essential ingredient necessary to keep diesel trucks moving is being withheld. I'm sorry to say, but the situation looks as though the anaconda is constricting to bring about starvation here. And while it may not be obvious yet, you must take precautions. If you're capable of raising your own food, that's sensational. But I fear that we're going to have a massive food shortage, food inflation, prices are going to skyrocket. You need to be prepared. There are several sites that provide food that is vacuum packed and will endure for lengthy periods of time, some of which is rather high quality for food of its kind. I urge you to stock up. Don't let yourself to be caught unprepared. It is all too obvious what is taking place. And while I'm going to do my best to keep you abreast of the current developments, you're going to have to fend for yourself when it comes to preparing for how you are going to cope when there's no more food on the shelves. I encourage you to do this. Check it out online. There are several sites that are very good. You can check out their ratings. You have, you know, feedback from customers. Go for it. Meanwhile, we're breaking down a flurry of legal filings by the Clinton campaign associates in Durham's prosecution of Michael Sussman. If you wanted evidence that Hillary was complicit here and that all this about the Russian thing was phony, in a coordinated legal action between a number of Hillary operatives and associates, almost 24 separate documents have been simultaneously filed on April 19th in special counsel Durham's case against former Clinton campaign lawyer Michael Sussman. The sudden flurry of mass filings include responses from former Clinton campaign manager John Podesta, campaign manager Robbie Mook, Clinton campaign lead lawyer Mark Elias, contractors Fusion GPS, the Clinton campaign itself, and the Democratic National Committee. The trigger for the flurry of filings was a request by Durham to unseal a number of emails involving the parties. The emails are currently being withheld on very questionable grounds of attorney-client privilege. Based on the coordinated filings, it appears a large number of important people associated with the Clinton campaign are very concerned about the information in those emails becoming public. Surprise, surprise. Based on available metadata, it appears as if most of the individuals involved in Clinton's scheme to vilify Trump with claims of Russia collusion were all communicating with each other as that scheme unfolded in real time. The first person who filed in response to Durham's request is Rodney Jaffe, the tech exec who produced data that purportedly tied Trump to Russia. Jaffe had been promised a top government job in case of a Hillary Clinton election victory. Jaffe claimed in his filing that his communication should be treated as privileged because they were part of his attorney-client relationship with Sussman. Jaffe was indeed a client of Sussman starting in 2015, but in an unexpected and perhaps unintentional comment, Jaffe also disclosed he had hired Sussman specifically to advise him how to share sensitive information concerning Trump with government agencies without revealing his identity and thereby exposing himself to potential liability. In effect, Jaffe publicly admitted he hired Sussman to take information about Trump to the FBI. The problem for Sussman is he's been charged with lying about exactly that point. Sussman claimed in an email to then-FBI General Counsel James Baker that he wasn't taking the information to the FBI on behalf of any client, but instead was merely acting as a good Samaritan. If Jaffe throwing Sussman under the proverbial bus weren't bad enough, the next filing was even worse for Sussman. It came from Clinton campaign operatives Fusion GPS, who also want their emails to be withheld from Durham. In order to obtain the benefit of attorney-client privilege, Fusion now claims to have assisted Sussman and his law firm with legal matters. That claim is demonstrably false, as Fusion's main role, acknowledged by Fusion's owners Glenn Simpson and Peter Frisch in their book, was to conduct opposition research on Trump and seed those stories in the media. To make matters even worse, Simpson and Frisch admitted that in writing in their 2019 book Crime in Progress, that very point. It appears as if Fusion's lawyers didn't read their client's book ahead of their filing. This blunder would not have gone unnoticed by Durham's team. The next filing has come from Perkins Coie, the legal firm for which Hillary's campaign lawyers, Sussman and Elias, worked in 2016. Perkins didn't want to disclose any of its emails either, but the excuse was a lot simpler. The firm noted that Elias had left the company last year and taken all of the related files with him. A separate submission came from Elias himself. Elias, a well-known Democrat Party lawyer, made an argument that essentially mirrored that of Fusion, namely that Fusion was providing Perkins Coie with input that was related to legal advice, and any communication were therefore covered by privilege. Elias failed to address the basic fact that Fusion had been hired to collect and disseminate opposition research to the media. Elias similarly did not address that Sussman himself had disseminated Fusion stories to the media, as well as to the FBI, thereby piercing any pretense of attorney-client privilege. The most telling filing came from Hillary's campaign manager, Robbie Mook. Like everyone else, Mook's main objective was to claim that everything that had been done took place within a legal advice relationship. But unlike the others, Mook didn't actually claim that everything was above board. Instead, he repeatedly asserted that he thought everything was done above board. In essence, Mook's filing essentially shifted the blame onto Elias and the other Hillary operatives. Mook's apparent refusal to confirm that everything was done legally may end up showcasing Mook as a weak link in the Hillary campaign effort to cover up the origins of the Russiagate scandal. This development is something that Durham, no doubt, will have taken note of. The overarching problem with these claims of privilege is that by legal necessity, they have to be based on legal advice. If the task at hand wasn't about legal advice, such as Fusion pushing false stories about Trump to the media, then there is no attorney-client privilege. With that backdrop in mind, Fusion GPS claimed in its filing that it was retained by then-partner Elias at Perkins Coie to assist in providing legal advice to its clients, the Hillary for America Campaign Committee and the DNC during the 2016 presidential campaign. As we noted earlier, Elias' own submission mirrored this claim. But there's a huge problem when we compare these new claims with an October 24, 2017 letter from Perkins Coie, which officially detailed its retention and hiring of Fusion on April 11, 2016. Matthew Geringer, general counsel for Perkins Coie, noted that Fusion approached Perkins Coie in early March of 2016. Geringer stated that Fusion expressed an interest in its continuation of research regarding then-presidential candidate Donald Trump, research that Fusion GPS had conducted for one or more other clients during the Republican primary contest. And it wasn't just Perkins Coie that was saying this. In their 2019 book, Fusion's owners told a very similar story, specifically that they had pitched the idea to Elias that they would continue to collect opposition research on Trump on Elias' behalf. There was never any mention from either Fusion or Elias of legal services or legal advice. Fusion appears to have now twisted the meaning of its engagement, stating that it wasn't really doing opposition research and media outreach, but was instead focused on privileged investigative work and analysis. There are several problems with Fusion's assertion, however. Dossier author Christopher Steele, who had been hired by Fusion to push Trump-Russia collusion stories, told a UK court under oath in May of 2017 that he was directed by Fusion GPS to speak with a number of media outlets on several different occasions. He testified that in September of 2016, he had personally briefed a large number of journalists at Fusion's instruction. Those journalists were from the New York Times, the Washington Post, Yahoo News, the New Yorker, and CNN. In October 2016, Steele was instructed once again to speak to the New York Times, Washington Post, Yahoo News, and Mother Jones. Based on Steele's stories, many of these outlets subsequently published extremely damaging stories about Trump-Russia collusion, none more so than Mother Jones' David Corn, who not only put out an article discussing the content of the dossier just ahead of the 2016 election, but also shared Steele's dossier reports with James Baker of the FBI. Notably, Baker was the same person who met with Sussman in September of 2016. Additionally, there were also multiple communications that took place between the owners of Fusion, Glenn Simpson and Peter Frisch, and various corporate media reporters during the same time frame. In a flurry of conversations on October 5th of 2016, Fusion's Frisch reached out to Tom Hamburger of the Washington Post, providing a supposed DNS data claiming links between the Trump Organization server and the Alpha Bank. Frisch then provided the same data to Michael Iskoff of Yahoo News. Frisch also provided NBC's Matthew Moss with a zip file of data in an email contained the subject line, "Dude, this is huge." Just a few weeks later, on October 18, 2016, Frisch wrote to Reuters' Mike Horsball on October 18, 2016, telling him, "Do the effing Alpha Bank secret comms story. It is hugely important." The actions of Fusion at the behest of Elias had nothing to do with legal advice. They did, however, have everything to do with establishing a false narrative, one that had been crafted by these Clinton operatives themselves, which is precisely why they are now panicking about their emails being released at Durham. But the flurry of filings was not the only major development in the Durham investigation. In a subsequent hearing Wednesday, a Durham prosecutor told Obama appointee Judge Christopher Cooper that the project to link Trump and Russia through DNS data had actually originated with Jaffe. The prosecution stated Jaffe's plan was carried out with the help of Clinton campaign agents. Durham's team also revealed there were meetings between Elias, Sussman, and Jaffe, during which Jaffe was allegedly encouraged to create imprints that would tie Trump to Russia through data. Sounds like forgeries, fabrications. It's not yet known how Durham's office came to know about the meeting between Elias, Jaffe, and Sussman. But if such a meeting actually did take place, it would completely destroy any pretense that the relationship between these parties had anything to do with providing legal services. This discovery could land Elias and Jaffe in significant legal trouble for lying in their filings to the court. Very significant, very troubling. A final point before we hit the break. A UK court has approved the extradition of Julian Assange to the US. The UK Home Secretary will decide on his fate. In Spotlight, they take a look at issues related to Assange, such as freedom of speech, the accusation itself, whether it should be called espionage given the depth of his revelations, and why Assange is being punished for revealing the ones who have committed felonies or murders. Where is the justice in that? We'll be right back.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back. It's James Fetzer here on Revolution Radio. It's the raw deal. So come on down and join us at freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. You can call and listen at 518-906-1859 and catch us today. Thanks, and God bless.
Thank you so much, for filling in, Mitchell. You're doing a great job on all fronts, which I profoundly appreciate. Meanwhile, there's a whole lot more going on out there in the world as I wait for, in the hope that James McCanny will be able to join, among those stories are that Tucker is saying lockdowns are coming to America next. I think Tucker's got it right. Here's what he had to say. Popular Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson recently covered the disturbing lockdowns taking place in Shanghai, China, warned that similar lockdowns could be heading to the United States next. I mean, it's not without precedent, is it? He spoke of the horrifying stories of Chinese citizens being forced to remain in their homes without access to food, all with a goal of eliminating the COVID virus. in the region. The army has even been deployed to control riots that were widely expected to take place in protests against the barbaric lockdowns forced upon the residents. Has there ever been a clear picture of what in hell is what hell is like? He asked before calling Shanghai the largest prison camp in human history. Carl said, we're only now just seeing how far some governments will go to oppress their citizens using COVID as an excuse. If you believe in democracy, this is repugnant. 25 million just lost their most basic human rights. So the question is, has anyone in the Biden administration, which is constantly lecturing us about democracy and human rights, said anything about this? No. The answer is no. Biden has nothing to say about it. And that's what's terrifying. It leaves open the possibility the United States government could take similarly drastic action to prevent the spread of a new variant of the COVID virus. It also means the government could take similar action in the event of the arrival of an entirely new virus. Well, I think Tucker has actually put his finger on what's going on here, namely that in order to forestall the massive wipeout at the midterm elections in November, that the government is going to claim, the CDC, that there's a new variant, they're going to bring about another lockdown, and they're going to require all voting by mail. It's as obvious as the nose on your face. Meanwhile, there are bizarre attacks on Donald Trump because they fear him most of all. He has such massive support. Here's this Colonel Vindman, the very guy who claimed that Trump's phone call with the Ukrainian president was somehow improper when there was nothing improper about it, claiming Trump has spiraled down mentally. He is not a viable contender for 2024. And I say, my God, if Trump has spiraled down mentally and is not a viable contender for 2024, what about this Biden guy? For God's sake, there is no comparison. This is just complete bullshit. If you want to hear what it sounds like, and of course it's coming from MSNBC. Catch this. Former National Security Council Director for European Affairs, U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman said Thursday on MSNBC's Deadline that former President Donald Trump has spiraled down mentally and therefore is not a viable candidate for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024. I mean, my God, has he not heard Trump speak lately? And the comparison with Biden is so grotesque. During an interview on Fox with Hannity, of all things, Trump said, I think in 100 years, people are going to look back and they're going to say, how did we stand back and NATO stand back? Which in many ways, speaking of NATO, I'm called a paper tiger. Don't forget, I rebuilt NATO. They treated us very badly on trade. We changed a lot of that around, but they were very tough on trade. Vindman said, honestly, it was word vomit. That's what we heard, what that clip showed. It's shocking he didn't have the intellect, the intelligence, to have the self-preservation to criticize somebody the vast majority of the American people despises and identifies as a barbarian, as a war criminal. And no doubt he's talking about Vladimir Putin. So, I mean, he's always been his own worst enemy, and he continues to do so now. He had it. I think he's incapable of leading. He was incapable of leading while in government, and I think he's devolved. I guess my question is, does he have the faculties? As bad as he was in the first Trump administration, he seems to have spiraled down. I don't know if that's, you know, if age or whatever it is that's going to get him now, that he's really incapable of piecing together coherent thoughts. I mean, literally, you would think he was talking about Joe Biden, not Donald Trump. He concludes, he is a coward. He can't simply call Putin out for his vile attacks on Ukraine or on the innocent Ukrainian people. I don't see how he can possibly be a viable contender for 2024. I don't believe he is. He may still be popular in the Republican Party when it comes to the general election. He's non-viable. He is done. I mean, frankly, that is unbelievable bullshit. unbelievable bullshit. That is so ridiculous. Meanwhile, an admissions association is going to help to lead a test option enrollment study. In other words, now that colleges are doing away with objective tests like the ACT and the SAT, which have in the past been used to screen out students who were not well prepared from those who are better prepared, and often identifying individuals who were exceptionally well prepared for higher level education, where the overwhelming majority of students now matriculating from high schools across the country clearly are not, will be subjected to study. Higher education's top admissions associate will spearhead a study examining how dropping the SAT and ACT as an entrance requirement affects college and university enrollment. The National Association for College Admission Counseling, through a $1.4 million Bill and Melinda Gates grant, will work with researchers who will review enrollment patterns of 154-year colleges, some of which adopted test optional policies. Bill and Melinda Gates again. The Equity Research Cooperative, Equity, a consultant, will also examine how test optional practices influenced enrollment of Black, Latino, Indigenous, Asian, and low-income students through a survey and six case studies conducted at selective and minority-serving institutions. By the way, one of the unmentioned aspects of all this testing business is that when you apply it generally, Asian students, Japanese and Chinese, are at the very top. So that there have been reports that Harvard is having to, you know, utilize racial criteria to screen out, or they'd be have an undergraduate body that was virtually 100% Chinese and Japanese. I mean, it's a fascinating aspect of this. The problem being that once we abandon merit, once we abandon ability, once we abandon achievement, we are squandering the nation's intellectual resources. Data from these pilots is beginning to emerge. The University of Missouri found first-year students admitted without the test had similar retention rates and only slightly lower GPAs than those who submitted SAT or ACT scores. Other research has sought to capture the impact of test optional admissions on a broader scale. One recent study of 99 private test optional institutions found the policy associated with a modest boost in the diversity of their student bodies. This is one advantage of test optional admissions. Opponents of entrance exams contend they say the SAT and ACT represent barriers for vulnerable students and are weighted to wealthy students who can afford extensive tutoring. Well, there are well-known socioeconomic aspects, educational level, and academic performance. This has nothing to do with wealthy students who can afford extensive tutoring. This is a very general, demographical, sociological, well-understood phenomenon. So many of the critics here really have their head where the sun does not shine. The NACAC's study differs from past research because it will examine a swath of newly test optional institutions, and Angela Perez, the organization's chief executive officer. The study was first announced in February, but the NACAC made its involvement in the project only known Wednesday. The study will allow higher education leaders to learn about the implications of test optional policies as well as give voice to underrepresented students undergoing admission processes. What are the best practices in a post-testing world? NACAC's role will be to coordinate, Perez said. That includes designing the project and convening researchers from the University of Maryland College Park and Colorado State, Penn State, and Southern Methodist to examine admission trends at the 150 colleges. Perez has been a public supporter of test optional admissions, but he said he's unconcerned about the perception of bias in this study because NACAC researchers are not conducting it. NACAC has previously called for standardized testing scores to be removed as a metric for calculating U.S. News and World Report's influential best colleges rankings. created a campaign cause test optional means test optional, which asks colleges to adopt these policies to affirm they will not penalize applicants for not submitting scores. Well, what you're doing is simply removing one criteria, one indicator of how well prepared a student is for college. It's never been viewed as determinative. It's never been the case that your SAT or ACT score alone would guarantee your admission. But when you're looking at a competitive pool, when you're looking at overwhelmingly more applicants than you have opportunities to provide, and you have seats in the classroom, the question becomes, what is a just and equitable, not equity, equitable, fair manner of distribution? And, of course, students who are well prepared, without any doubt, in my opinion, deserve, for a whole host of reasons. If you don't have the best prepared students in higher education, then the higher education no longer serves a function of higher education, but becomes a remedial institution to compensate for inadequate preparation at lower levels. Inadequate preparation at lower levels. So if you don't want, you know, colleges and universities to become glorified high schools, you have to be selective in your admission so you can build on the background of students who are prepared. If you take students who are not prepared, and I cannot imagine a more reliable indicator than these objective exams, the SAT and the ACT, then you're going to fail in your mission. You're going to change the function of colleges and universities to be remedial instead of advancing understanding, not merely conveyors of old knowledge and the sources of discovery of new knowledge, but in inculcating the methods and principles of research and investigation that every student needs to possess in order to survive and thrive in a world where sorting out the difference between good data and bad, true information and false, real news and fake news has become increasingly indispensable as the American media has completely failed in its obligation to perform the functions for which it was ostensibly intended. Meanwhile, you know how much censorship is taking place. We'll get this. Twitter took down a tweet quoting the English playwright William Shakespeare. I mean, can you believe this? The quote was removed by Twitter for abuse and harassment. Shakespeare was being quoted a line from Henry VI, Part 2, namely the line, "Let's kill all the lawyers." Peter Kirwan, an associate professor at the University of Nottingham in the UK, tweeted out the quote as part of a message of support to the Nottingham Shakespeare Rebels Acting Group. Here was a tweet. "Really excited for Knott's Rebels taking the stage with the RSC for today's Henry VI press performances," Kirwan tweeted. "Break a leg, everyone, and do kill all the lawyers." The original quote is spoken by Dick the Butcher in Act 4, Scene 2 of the play as part of his response to the rebel leader, Jack Haight. Stand by. Jack Haight's musing about what he would do if he were king. Some have interpreted the quote as a statement that opposes bureaucracy, which is represented by the lawyers, while others argue the quote is a compliment to lawyers because they're represented as maintaining justice in society. But Twitter claimed that Kirwan's tweet violated its rules on abuse and harassment, removed the tweet, and locked Kirwan out of his account. This is just about as absurd as it gets. Here we see delete tweet. Tweet one of one, violating our rules against abuse and harassment. You may not engage in the targeted harassment of someone or incite other people to do so. This includes wishing or hoping that someone experiences physical harm. And here's his tweet from William Shakespeare. "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." April 5th, 2022. By clicking delete, you acknowledge that your tweet violated the Twitter rules. Well, the Twitter rules are really frankly absurd, and they're not even being implemented by human beings. They're doing this using algorithms that have been programmed to pick out certain phrases and expressions. There's not a thinking thing involved in any of these decisions. I'm even skeptical when you appeal one of these decisions made by these automated mechanisms that you're going to be reviewed by a thinking thing. But at the best, that's the first time you'll have an encounter with anything that understands the meaning of words rather than operates on strings of zeros and ones, syntax, that means nothing whatsoever for the machine that's processing it. Meanwhile, Alec Baldwin, safety report exonerates me in the shooting of the cinematographer. This has been of considerable public interest, and therefore I pursue it. Actor Alex Baldwin says a report issued by the New Mexico Occupational and Safety Bureau clears him of any wrongdoing in the death of cinematographer Hallian Hutchins, who was accidentally shot and killed by Baldwin in October 2021 on the set of the movie Rust. I must say the word accidentally is a bit begging the question, because the circumstances under which this occurred, exactly who is responsible and why, has not been fully determined. In particular, since he was holding the gun, since he pulled the trigger, while he may insist it was accidental, in my judgment, it remains to be determined. We are grateful to the New Mexico Occupational and Safety Bureau for investigating this matter, the statement from Baldwin reads. We appreciate the report exonerates Mr. Baldwin by making clear that he believed the gun held only dummy rounds. Additionally, the report recognizes that Mr. Baldwin's authority on the production was limited to approving script changes and creative casting. Mr. Baldwin had no authority over the matters that were the subject of the Bureau's findings of violations, and we are pleased that the New Mexico officials have clarified these critical issues. We are confident the individuals identified in the report will be held accountable for the tragedy. The producers were fined the max of $136,793 and strongly criticized by authorities for showing plain indifference to recognize hazards associated with the use of firearms on the set. Baldwin, however, is also a producer. The report said Rust movie production management knew that firearm safety procedures were not being followed on the set and demonstrated plain indifference to employee safety by failing to review work practices and take corrective action. The company said it disagreed with the findings and would appeal. New Mexico Environmental Department Cabinet Secretary James Kennedy said, there were several management failures and more than sufficient evidence to suggest that if standard industry practices were followed, the fatal shooting of Hallian Hutchins and the serious injury of Joel Souza would not have occurred. Meanwhile, and this is actually a rather fascinating story, you know, January 6th was completely contrived. It was a manufactured event, and that it's being used in an attempt to deny Donald Trump the ability to run for president of the United States on the basis of an obscure provision of the 14th Amendment that says anyone has sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution and participates in an insurrection may not run for federal office. Well, I previously reported an article from the Federalist showing that, in relation to Donald Trump, he was neither inciting nor were the events that took place an insurrection. No one thought they actually were going to overthrow the government of the United States. And incitement has to do with encouraging imminent lawless activity. Well, had Trump been encouraging lawless activity, which he was not, he was simply encouraging his followers to peacefully protest. It couldn't have been imminent because he was a mile and a half speaking at the Ellipse, a mile and a half away, and he only finished speaking at 1:11, whereas these events at the Capitol began at 12:45. They appear to have been orchestrated by Nancy Pelosi, the Capitol Police, the FBI, which had agents, a fellow named Ray Epps especially, by Antifa, where James, a brother of John Sullivan, said John had led 226 Antifa members dressed as Trump supporters into the Capitol in order to, you know, sow division so Pelosi and other Democrats could have this alleged grounds for denying Trump the opportunity to run again. He knows they will clean their clock again. Well, here's an interesting piece by Josh Blackman and S.B. Tillman, which you can find on my blog at jamesfetzer.org. I'll talk a bit about it. The events of January 6, 2021 are casting a long shadow over the midterm elections. Voters in North Carolina are seeking to bar Representative Madison Cawthorn, who's a paraplegic confined to a wheelchair, from running for re-election to his House seat, and those in Georgia are trying to do the same to Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. The voters have filed complaints with state election officials arguing that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment disqualifies members of Congress who engage in insurrection from appearing on the congressional ballot. Charges to other elected officials have also begun involving other candidates, but these challenges face an intractable problem. Only the federal government, not the states, can disqualify insurrectionists from congressional ballots. States cannot unilaterally create procedures unless authorized by federal statute to keep accused insurrectionists off the congressional ballot. If these members of Congress engage in an insurrection, then the U.S. House of Representatives may exclude them, or federal prosecutors may charge them with a federal crime of insurrection. But in light of an important 1869 judicial decision, the cases against Mr. Cawthorn and Ms. Green, who are currently mired in both state and federal proceedings, cannot remove the candidates from the congressional ballot. The 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868 in the wake of the Civil War. Section 3 disqualified many former Confederates from holding certain public offices if they'd taken an oath to support the U.S. Constitution, but subsequently, as Section 3 declares, engaged in insurrection or rebellion. Since 1868, the federal judiciary has had few occasion to interpret Section 3. As a result, the courts are largely in uncharted territory. Nevertheless, there's important on-point precedent. We'll be hitting the break right now, back after. See you there.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of a library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. 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 Radio.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Revolution Radio. It's the Raw Deal with Dr. James Fetzer. Jim will be right back here in a second. Thanks for supporting and coming down and joining us here on Revolution Radio. God bless you. And remember that you can change the world today. Just tell the truth in this time of universal deceit, because that's what they fear. They fear that you will tell the truth and not play the song, the dance, dance to their tune, as the mainstream media fills your mind with illusions and delusions. So come on down and join us at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio. Take it away, Jim.
Mitchell, wonderful. I'm so grateful to you. You have no idea what's going on here at this end. I'm having to cope with. It's not James not being here is a minor matter compared to other issues. So I'm very grateful for your understanding and assistance. Meanwhile, it looks very obvious that the Democrats are going to try to play out this idea of Marjorie Taylor Greene, Donald Trump, and others as being insurrectionists. I think it's going to fall flat. But it's indicative of the level of their desperation and their apprehension of being wiped off the map that they, in the midterms especially, that they're resorting to such tactics. But then they had to go way out of their way to steal the election in 2020. They had to fabricate the events of the January 6th, clearly intended for specifically this purpose. It had no other role, and when the true history of January 6th is known, it will be a huge blot and stain on the Democrat Party, which is nevertheless, of course, you know, doing a marvelous job of self-immolation with this guy, this fake president, and this phony pandemic, but the all-too-real vax, which is taking vast numbers of lives. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin, who explained exactly what he was about and why he had to intervene in Ukraine back in his speech on February 24th, which you can find on my blog at jamesfetzer.org, it is also seeking to telegraph to the United States that it's a very unwise thing to providing weapons to Ukraine. He has now tested a new Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile in what Putin himself has hailed as a truly unique weapon. For the launch, of course, coming in during the war in Ukraine, is supposed to be heightening global tensions, but it really is just a signal from Russia that you don't want to mess with the bear. Russia's defense ministry announced Wednesday it had conducted the first test launch of its new Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile, a nuclear weapon President Putin says will provide food for thought for those who try to threaten our country. Putin also called Wednesday's reported launch a big, significant event for Russia's defense industry. The missile was launched Wednesday from the Pelest test launch facility in northern Russia, and its practice warheads hit designated targets at the Kura firing range on the far eastern Kamchatka Peninsula. This truly unique weapon will strengthen the combat potential of our armed forces, reliably ensure Russia's security from external threats, and provide food for thought for those who, in the heat of frenzied aggressive rhetoric, try to threaten our country. The Sarmat is a heavy missile intended to replace a Soviet-made Vyatvoda missile, which was codenamed Satan by the West. Putin and his officials say it's capable of penetrating any prospective missile defense. It has no analog in the world and won't for a long time to come. I'm understanding it has multiple warheads, I think a dozen, possibly more, that they travel at speeds that make it virtually impossible to stop, and that just one of these missiles could take out virtually every aircraft carrier that NATO possesses in a single stroke. Meanwhile, the consequences of, you know, cutting off gas from Russia, which was really what this was all about, because the United States defense industry fears that cordial relations between Germany and Russia are going to lead to reduced tensions, no more apprehension of a Russian invasion, but a rather an economic partnership. That's what they don't want. Because if there are reduced tensions in Europe, then it will become all the more obvious that NATO is an anachronism, that it has no more role to play, and that Europe really does not need to continue to expend vast sums for very expensive American military equipment. That's really a lot of what's going on. It was intended to undermine the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that was about to be open. The timing here is no coincidence. So, Germans are told to take fewer showers as energy costs bite. Reduce your living standards to stand with Ukraine. As energy costs continue to bite thanks to the sanctions on Russia, Germans are being told to take fewer showers. Yes, really. Amidst discussion in the country of a potential total energy embargo on Russia, articles about the supposed health benefits of showering less have begun to pop up. In an article titled, "It's Enough to Wash These Four Body Parts, Why the Skin Cleans Itself If You Let It," Germany's Bild newspaper cites advice by Economy Minister Robert Habeck, who has called on citizens to cut back on their heating, sauna visits, and showers, help the country reduce its dependence on Russian energy. The piece claims that avoiding showers gives good bacteria a chance to propagate, helping with skin conditions, and also consuming the substances responsible for body odor. This way, the skin cleans itself, states the article, arguing dubiously that avoiding washing your body will actually make you smell better. According to Adler, Germans can save energy and keep themselves clean enough by washing just four areas of the body, bottom, armpits, feet, and groin. In some countries, this is colloquially known as a whore's wash. A whore's wash. So that's what you get in Germany now. Meanwhile, inside the Mariupol drama theater where 300-plus people are supposed to have been killed, Ukraine claims that Donetsk Regional Drama Theater in Mariupol was used as an air raid shelter during the stage of Mariupol, allegedly hoping up to 1,300 civilians, and that on 16 March, at least 300 victims could have been killed as a result of a Russian airstrike. In my previous report, I've interviewed people who were in and around the theater in days leading up to the day of the tragedy and during the explosion that killed so many there. In those interviews, I was told a range of options and facts about what happened. These include a man who was in the theater during the explosions who said that every day Ukrainian forces would use the theater as a firing position, and even some Ukraine soldiers were inside, and he thinks because of this, Russia may have thought it was being used as a military base. Another woman told me she thought it was shelled by the Azov battalion, as you've seen shells obviously fired from Ukrainian-controlled territory. Some DPR forces have told me they think it was being used by Ukraine as a military base and firing position. Obviously, there are many conflicting stories about what happened. So I've gone to the theater to investigate for myself. In this special report, we saw what appeared to be the remains of what was an area where civilians were staying, but we also found Ukrainian military uniforms inside. We don't know how long they may have been there. Meanwhile, Russia has gained massive negative press. For example, here's our cartoon showing that huge machinery for strip mining that is labeled Russia, where the control is Putin, and it's strip mined Ukraine, and what's coming out is just a massive pile of bodies, a massive pile of bodies. And there's a lot like that, a very savage anti-Russia political cartoons. Meanwhile, a Ukrainian official has acknowledged that Russia captured 42 villages in the Donetsk region on Thursday. That would be yesterday. Russian forces captured 42 villages in the eastern Donetsk region on Thursday, but Ukraine might take them back, an aide to the chief of staff of President Zelensky told national television. Today, 42 villages were added to the list of those that have been occupied. This is at the expense of the Donetsk region, said the aide, Olena Simonenko. This happened today, and it might be that our forces will win them back tomorrow. Meanwhile, we know there's a whole lot of bad stuff going on in Ukraine. Meanwhile, State of the Nation, concerned about the kind of demonization of Russia and Putin that's taking place, and holding up the Ukrainian president as though he were some kind of hero, or our fake president is revealing to Ukraine as our partners. State of the Nation, which is an excellent publication, has just included a graphic video. Listen to this. Ukrainian Nazis now crucifying young Christian men and burning them at the stake. Yes. State of the Nation editor's note. Some folks may question why this alt-media platform would post such a horrific video for all to view. The answer is quite simple. The entire U.S. government corporate complex has been aggressively pushing all of America into a pen of blind compliance with their nationwide, "We support Ukraine, I stand with Ukraine" psyop. just like the same bad actors deceitfully promoted were all in this together throughout the COVID era. Now they are conning the American people into avidly supporting the barbaric Nazi regime in Kiev. But the claimed genocidal maniacs are trying their hardest to begin World War III by forever demonizing Russia while gushing cringeworthy praise for the brutal Nazi government of Ukraine. If Americans knew just how much of a neo-Nazi and neocon Zionist President Zelensky really is, they'd scream bloody murder, especially when they understand that his administration and military have been slaughtering Ukrainian civilians at every opportunity. Virtually every attack on Ukrainian hospitals and civilian infrastructure has been carried out by the armed forces of Ukraine or the National Guard of Ukraine, and particularly by the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion, a unit of the National Guard. Likewise, it was those Azov Nazi savages who perpetrated the viciously ruthless crucifixion and burning shown below. Until U.S. citizens see and hear the searing raw truth, they will blindly jump on the Ukraine bandwagon that's slowly taking the world off the cliff. That's why we posted this deeply disturbing and truly horrifying video. I sought to download it, but as yet have been unable to do so. Azov, meanwhile, begs to be allowed to flee to an unspecified third nation. This is from Investment Watch blog. The American exceptional way of doing things is to carpet bomb from 20,000 feet for weeks on end. Ilya Pomonarenko tweets, interpreting it for you guys from Putin's into human language. Our forces in Mariupol are extremely exhausted after over 50 days in fierce urban combat. And we just can't spend even more time and resources to Zerg rush this 5-kilometer-wide steel plant turned into a giant fortress. If Russia really were guilty of war crimes, then there'd be nothing stopping them from sending a few missiles into the industrial plant and taking out most of the Azovs hiding there with human shields. In comparison to most military campaigns, this one has been fought with kid gloves. American forces didn't hesitate to firebomb Dresden multiple times, killing thousands of civilians, one of the greatest atrocities of World War II, yes, committed by the United States. Here's another tweet from Anton Andropov. UA struggle. An urgent appeal from the deputy commander of the Azov regiment, said Toislav Palomar from the blockaded Mariupol. Russia has disrupted today's evacuation of civilians. The Azov regiment asked for guarantees on the safety of women and children. Now, why would civilians voluntarily enter the bowels of an industrial complex where is there no food or water with a band of besieged neo-Nazis instead of leaving through the Russian aid corridors like everyone else? The only possible explanation there would be civilians in the Azov tunnels is Azov dragged them down there for their own benefit and their own protection. Meanwhile, back at home, Biden misspeaks giving mask mandate answer to Title 42 question. President Biden misspoke while fielding questions from reporters Thursday, giving an answer on a topic unrelated to question posed and forcing White House staff to once again issue a correction on behalf of the president. Following a live address on April 21st on renewed military aid to Ukraine, a reporter asked Biden whether his administration is considering delaying the end of Title 42, the public health policy that limits immigration and is set to end next month. Biden, 79, then proceeded to give an answer conflating the Title 42 issue with that of federal mask mandates. No, he began, what I am considering is continue to hear from my. First of all, there's going to be an appeal by the Justice Department, DOJ, because as a matter of principle, we want to be in a position where if, in fact, it is strongly concluded by the scientists that we need Title 42, that we'd be able to do that. The Justice Department, however, is not appealing the decision to end Title 42, a call made by the Center for Disease Control, but is appealing a ruling by a federal judge that the CDC's mask requirement for public transportation was beyond its legal authority. Biden finished off his answer by returning to the issue of Title 42, saying, "There has been no decision on extending Title 42. Following the press conference, White House staff issued a statement to reporters on behalf of President Biden. "I want to clarify that in comments at the conclusion of my remarks this morning, I was referring to the CDC's mask mandate, and there is no Department of Justice action on Title 42. The White House has had to clarify the president's comments after the fact many times in recent months. During a press conference in January, for example, as Russia was massing troops along Ukraine's border in preparation for an invasion, Biden said Russia might face fewer penalties from the United States for a minor incursion into Ukraine. Ukraine President Zelensky responded by saying there are no minor incursions on small nations. And White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki released a statement seeking to clarify Biden's comment by saying the president was clear with the Russian president. If any Russian military forces move across the Ukrainian border, that's a renewed invasion, and it will be met with a swift, severe, and united response. About 2 months later, during a press conference in Belgium, Biden said the United States would respond in kind if Russia used chemical weapons in Ukraine. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan later had to make clear to reporters aboard Air Force One that the United States has no intention of using chemical weapons, period, under any circumstances. They were drawing a red line so they could fake a chemical attack, just as it occurred in Syria again and again and again, and blame it on Russia to justify NATO involvement. While on the same European trip, Biden told a group of Army paratroopers in Poland that they would witness the bravery of Ukrainian civilians defending their country while you are there. The U.S. had to mop this up as well, releasing a statement saying, "The president has been clear. We are not sending U.S. troops to Ukraine, and there is no change in that position." Also, while in Poland, Biden ended a speech saying Putin cannot remain in power, causing confusion as to whether the United States was seeking to topple the Russian regime. White House staff again had to clarify, saying Biden was not discussing Putin's power in Russia. Biden himself later said he's not walking the statement back, but sought to add context by saying, "I was talking to the Russian people, and that it's more an aspiration than anything that he should not be in power." Oh, wow. Meanwhile, Tony the Rat, it's called the mask mandate cancellation on public transit, unfortunate. Dr. Anthony Fauci wasn't happy with a Florida federal judge's landmark ruling from earlier this week, characterizing the cancellation of the Biden admin's national mask mandate for public transportation as unfortunate. Fauci, the chief White House medical advisor, who's been in the public eye for more than 2 years because of the COVID pandemic, said District Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell's ruling superseded the authority of the CDC. "I don't think there's really any serious room for doubt. The judge appears to have been exactly right in her decision." In his response, however, Fauci also did not account for how Americans now have tremendous access to COVID-19 vaccines and treatments, or how the Biden admin still wants to repeal the CDC Title 42 health order at the U.S.-Mexican border. Instead, Fauci seemingly wants to preserve the status quo, even though COVID infections in the U.S. have precipitously declined in recent weeks. Well, I follow the CDC guidelines, and the CDC wants to extend the mandate for the 15-day period beyond April 18th up to May 3rd. The reason they want to do that is they wanted to see what the pattern of infection is during this bit of a surge we're seeing, he said during an interview with USA Today. On Wednesday, The CDC instructed the Department of Justice to appeal the Trump-appointed judge's cancellation ruling, ending a mask mandate that had coincided with Joe Biden's presidency. To protect CDC's public health authority beyond the ongoing assessment announced last week, CDC has asked DOJ to proceed with an appeal in the Health Freedom Defense Fund Incorporated et al. Versus Biden et al., the CDC said in a statement, while adding the previous mask mandate was necessary for the public health. The agency added, CDC will continue to monitor public health conditions to determine whether such an order remains necessary. CDC believes this is a lawful order, well within CDC's legal authority to protect public health. This week, social media posters and TV viewers were treated to a number of videos and still photos chronicling the precise moment at which various airlines dropped mask mandates for airplane travel, some of which occurred in mid-flight. The photos show a large number of maskless plane passengers celebrating their newfound freedom of choice after 2 years of flying with a mask obligation. Of course, within this new freedom of choice, plane passengers can continue to wear a mask on flights. And let me observe, if the masks work and you want to wear a mask, since you take for granted that works, why should you worry if anyone else is not wearing a mask? After all, you've got your mask, and by your own belief, it works, so you're safe and secure. This week, White House Secretary Jen Psaki had a tent session with the media when pressed on the potential hypocrisy of rescinding Title 42 at the southern border, but also wanting to keep public transportation mask mandates in check. It was also the reality of states abandoning their mask mandates indoors en masse. Psaki shot back saying, I'm not a doctor, you're not a doctor that I'm aware of, when raising a question from a Fox News reporter. Meanwhile, I'll be glad to take your calls now in the final section of the show. The number 540-352-4452, 540-352-4452. Very sorry James McCanny could not join. I will make contact and see if I can get him on the show with me on Monday so we can stand by and anticipate that's in the works. Meanwhile, again, call in after the break. 540-352-4452, and Mitchell will field your call and get you on the air. We'll be right back.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Yeah.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm glad to take your calls. There's so much going on. And politics has never been in a more desperate plight, it seems to me, right here in the USA. I wish the situation were so very, very different. Mitchell, you've been doing a great job here. Join, what do you think are some of the most important issues confronting us now, right now, including those that I've been addressing here today? Please, my friend, join.
Hey, hi, Jim. Hey, thank you. You know, I keep watch on this, the Trump, Russia collusion, lie, the attempted political assassination of Donald Trump. You know, for me, you know, because I was too young when JFK got assassinated, really, to have any impact or have any real knowledge of that, anything. You know, this was pretty much the, you know, the biggest political assassination, that was clearly visible. And, you know, as the Durham investigation rolls on, every day there's more information coming out. As now they know that, some of the tech people that were working at Georgia Tech, snooping on Donald Trump also were, later working for, Robert Mueller. And, some of that was at the request of DARPA, to find and manufacture a list of a potential Russian hackers for the DNC hack in the search for Grucifer 2.0. So, you know, I see this disturbing pattern, I guess you could call it, you know, that as I have said, you know, before, on my Tuesday night show, the Trump assassination files. You know, this to me in my political lifetime, you know, Nixon in retrospect was a, you know, really the, one of the first big victims of the media leak strategy by the CIA and the New World Order that's taken over our government. But this, you know, this thing with Donald Trump, you know, it shows that the entire government is so corrupted, that, you know, agencies are essentially captured by the New World Order, just as eight other government agencies are captured in regulatory capture, you know, by the organizations they're supposed to regulate. It's a complete failure of government that we are seeing, and it's unfortunate. And that's the biggest thing that I focus on, that I worry about. So of course, Ukraine is, you know, this World War III light right now. I just don't think we have gotten into the heavy parts. I was just reading online, while you were talking earlier, and you're going to shake your head on this, that the United States is going to send tanks to Poland so Poland can send them to Ukraine.
And isn't Poland a member of NATO? I mean, this is not going to work, Mitchell. This is not going to work. What's going on here is you have the United States openly, blatantly provoking the bear. And I tell you, Russia can wipe out the United States. We may think we are, you know, supreme among nations, but it ain't the case. It's an illusion. By the way, I did not realize you got a whole show devoted to the JFK assassination. You were very kind to put me together with Joaquin Agopian this morning on his show, my first time there, where we wound up addressing the assassination of JFK. Tell me, what was your take? What did you find most provocative or surprising, if indeed there was anything there of which you were not already aware?
Well, I can't lie. I was prepared for my show.
Okay. That's not a problem, Mitchell. But I'm telling you.
I can't lie. I spent two hours preparing for my shows, usually in the morning, finishing up getting news information and, you know, and then kind of getting my mindset, because, you know, when you go in and you do 2 hours of a show, you kind of almost have to get your mindset to do that. One of the things that I find interesting is that, you know, all of the different possibilities of the different snipers that, you know, at first, you know, they had just the shooter, you know, just Lee Harvey Oswald in the book depository. And now there are, you know, these ideas or possibilities of a large number of different shooters. And that kind of puzzles me in a way. I don't know if it's the audio soundtracks that would be within on the Zapruder film, if there's any audio of the assassination. It just seems that, you know, with the development of so many other possible shooters, that none of them have kind of ever been seen early in the investigation in the JFK. Conspiracy theorists were then defined as, well, conspiracy theorists, and they can't be, you know, questioned or trusted or anything. So, I often, you know, wonder about that, because, we had for a number of years, it's all so suspicious. And, you know, if it was me and it was JFK and the federal government, you know, we would have exhumed, his body long ago to get the magic bullet, that would not have stayed in his body. You know, that's such a national importance, you know, that we get our government back on track, and the perpetrators be held accountable. you know, we have so much, there ends up being so much ambiguity in the history, and that's because people don't define, it's not clearly present at the beginning, and then the government or others manage it, the perception later. And I think that's something they've really gotten good at today, you know, in every kind of shooting and every event, and, you know, the post management of that happening, of that event, whether it be real or staged. They have really gotten their act together so they can manage and massage, you know, all, everything to their benefit. And that's why, you know, I really like this idea of this national, you know, we live in this national Milgram Stanford prison project, you know, that's essentially what we live in today between our government and our media and the psychological, soup that we're put in, that we're mixed in, so they can get their pound of your mind or your flesh, whichever they need at the time. That makes sense.
Well, yes, yes, yes. Well, I spent a huge amount on JFK, and you know, I brought together the best experts in the world to ever study the case, and I have four books, three of which in my initial trilogy, Assassination Science 1998, Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, and The Great Zapruder Film Hoax 2003, blew apart the cover-up. And once you realize the autopsy x-rays were altered, that another brain was substituted for that of JFK, that the home movies were massively edited and revised, you realize there are only a tiny number of sources that could have performed those acts, including, in the case of the medical evidence, naval officers at Bethesda and members of the Secret Service. In the case of the Zapruder, was only in the hands of the Secret Service, which, however, was complicit. This is where trading on the popular belief that the Secret Service is defending the president, they overlooked the option that the Secret Service actually set him up for the hit. In fact, when Nigel Turner interviewed me for the episode 6 of The Men Who Killed Kennedy, or I believe it was actually 7, entitled The Smoking Guns, it was because I had sorted out 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit, including leaving behind 2 agents at Love Field who would have been running beside or on the back of the presidential limousine, putting the vehicles in the wrong order, one of the most important tells. So they had the presidential limousine right out front, when it ought to have been roughly in the middle, certainly following the lower-ranking dignitaries, where the mayor ought to become first, and then a vice president, so the crowd cheers for the mayor, and then their enthusiasm grows for the vice president. And finally, I mean, once you've seen Jack and Jackie, why would you hang around to watch Lyndon or Mayor Campbell, who, by the way, turns out joined the CIA by 1957, who was a brother of Charles Campbell, who was a Lieutenant Air Force General of the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs, whom JFK removed from office along with Richard Bissell, who was the co-director of plans at the time. And you know, you begin to put all the pieces together and you realize why Dealey Plaza was a perfect location. It was a Campbell Brothers' backyard. Mm-hmm. They knew the city inside out. The sheriff of Dallas County ran the county with an iron hand. He declared that security for the motorcade ended at Houston and Elm. In other words, just as the motorcade was entering the killing zone, they didn't cover the open windows. They didn't weld the manhole covers. Ordinarily, that would have been the case, to investigate every building and every occupant to make sure there were no threats to the president. In fact, they had been notified, they'd altered so that there was supposed to have been no national security threat to the president of the United States within like 50 or 100 miles of Dallas, which is about as absurd a claim as one could possibly make. The motorcycle escort was cut down to 4 and ordered not to ride ahead of the rear wheels, which one of the officers said was the damnedest formation he'd ever heard. The 110th Military Intelligence Unit was ordered to stand down instead of be distributed through the town for crowd control, where the crowd was allowed to spill out 810 into the street. I have one photograph where the presidential limousine is right beside a bus, Mitchell, and the crowd is just spilling out. I mean, an assassin with a handgun could have taken him out. The bus. I mean, it's just absurd. So we have all of these indications of, you know, how the Secret Service set him up. And then, of course, it turns out the autopsy x-rays, which were taken into custody by the Secret Service itself. The next time we see them, the photographs have been altered. The x-rays have been faked. The Secret Service had custody and control. And you begin to understand the elements who could have brought this out had to be very high in the American government. Indeed, Noel Twyman, who was a retired engineer, published a book back in 1997 explaining how the combinations for the perfect conspiracy entailed bringing together the Secret Service with the FBI and the military and the CIA, and that Lyndon Johnson was in a perfect position to make all those pieces come together. The motives of different groups were so very powerful. Jack, after all, had been threatening to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. The agency did not take that well. The Joint Chiefs were disillusioned with Jack because he had not been following their unanimous recommendations, which had included to invade Cuba, which he declined to do. They opposed signing an above-ground test ban treaty for nuclear weapons with the Soviet Union, which he signed in spite of their opposition. Now he was directing that American forces be withdrawn from Vietnam by the end of 1964. Where the chiefs believed that a stand had to be taken to, you know, defeat the expansion of international communism, which was a myth. I mean, the whole domino theory that Nixon talked about as well was just a fabrication. The Vietnamese were fiercely nationalistic. They had particular contempt for China. Vietnam would never have been a stooge or a puppet of China. And yet, according to this official mythology, if Vietnam fell, then would Cambodia, Laos, you know, Indonesia, the Philippines, New Zealand, Australia. I mean, it was a fantastic scenario, and it was all bullshit. It was all just complete bullshit. Then you had the mob. The mafia was upset because Bobby had cracked down on organized crime. You find the mob believed they had an agreement. And for all I know, they may have had an agreement with Joe, but they most certainly did not have an agreement with Bobby or Jack, that if they assisted JFK in becoming president, ostensibly by making sure that Chicago and therefore Illinois went for JFK, that they would lay off of the mob. But instead, when Bobby became attorney general, he cracked down on organized crime. He brought more indictments and prosecutions and convictions than ever before in the history of the mafia, where J. Edgar himself had even denied the existence of organized crime, because just as Edgar had sex files on all the members of Congress, the mafia had a sex file on Edgar in, shall we call it, compromising positions with his close personal friend, Colson, Colson, who he made an assistant to the director, and using those, they were able to blackmail Hoover. So until the Joe Valachi hearings, where the whole structure of the mafia was laid out in such detail, it could no longer be denied that Edgar insisted there was no such thing as organized crime. And then you had the Easter establishment surrounding the Fed, very upset because Jack had instructed the Department of the Treasury to print United States notes instead of Federal Reserve. I remember as a young Marine Corps officer holding one of these in my hand with a red embossed imprint saying United States note instead of the green Federal Reserve note, on the ground that It was absurd for the American government to be paying a consortium of private banks to print the currency of the United States at interest when the Department of Treasury could print the United States currency at no interest. Indeed, most of our national debt is because of compound interest on the interest owed to the Fed for printing the currency of the United States. The Texas oilmen were upset because he was threatening to cut the oil depletion allowance, which they regarded as akin to their divine right. They gave them a massive tax write-off, close to 25%, on the ostensible ground that oil, being a finite resource, pumping oil out of the ground was putting themselves out of business. The anti-Castro Cubans, of course, were upset with Jack. They believed he had betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. It wasn't actually true, since Jack had made clear from the beginning that there must be no U.S. military involvement. But the whole thing became such a fiasco that the CIA, which had performed a bait and switch, actually thought the young, inexperienced president would call in the Marines rather than take egg on his face, with Jack surprised him by taking responsibility, which led to an investigation of what had happened. And revealed that the CIA had misled him, that they knew Castro had already been informed by the Soviet Union, which had learned the date of the invasion. So Castro knew we were coming. The CIA knew that Castro knew we were coming. Everyone knew what was going on except for the commander-in-chief himself, who would undoubtedly have called it off. So, you know, there was quite a formidable array of forces, and Lyndon was in the perfect position to coordinate everything. In fact, as it would play out, he sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. And where it appears, each of the groups involved put up their own shooter. So when I go through, you know, the sequence of shots and the effects they had, the first hit on Jack was fired from the top of the county record building by a Dallas County sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford, who'd obtained a high-quality silencer shortly before the event, but was using a .30-06, a Fire Mannlicher Carcano bullet, to implant into the back of Jack using a plastic collar known as a sabot. Jim Mars and I, among others, discussed this in detail and agreed completely about this. One of the striking features of my conversation with Joaquin that you would have missed then, Mitchell, is that I explained how Sam Kenny, who was a Secret Service agent, had discovered this bullet implanted in Jack's back in the vehicle, in the back of the car, and that he'd taken it inside the Parkland Hospital and left it on a stretcher. He confided this to a neighbor with a solemn assurance he wouldn't reveal the facts of the matter until after his death. But that's the origin of the magic bullet. It wasn't Jack Ruby planted the bullet. Sam Kinney, a Secret Service agent, found it in the vehicle, and he himself put it on a stretcher, where David W. Manick, MD, PhD, is a leading expert on the medical evidence, took a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions at JFK and plotted the official trajectory. The bullet actually had hit 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column. But they had moved it upward after they discovered that a bullet had missed and injured the distant bystander, James Tague, with which you're undoubtedly well familiar, so that while the Secret Service and the FBI concluded there had been 3 shots with 3 hits, that Jack had been hit in the back, then Connolly had been hit in the back, then Jack had been hit in the back of the head, killing him. Now they had to account for all these wounds using only 2 bullets. Well, since Jack had also been hit in the throat by a bullet that passed through the windshield fired by an Air Force expert by the name of Jack Lawrence from inside the Triple Underpass using a special new weapon, of which only a small number were ever made, one of which was given to Curtis LeMay, who is at the time, of course, the head of the Air Force, and where I believe LeMay gave the weapon to Jack Lawrence to use so that he would know he was acting on behalf of the United States, because Curtis LeMay had authorized him to participate in the assassination, where Bob Livingston, a world authority on the human brain, who is also an expert on wound ballistics, discerned that throat shot had to have hit bone and splintered, part going down into the lung and part going upward to rupture this tough membrane that covers the cerebellum, known as the tentorium, because as he explained to me, on a flight together to Dallas for the 40th observance of the assassination in 2003, otherwise it could not have been the cerebellar tissue, where the cerebellum is a compact part of the brain at the base extruding from the wound, and yet you had physician after physician at Parkland describing cerebellum as well as cerebral brain tissue extruding through this fist-sized blowout at the back of the head, where those two shots were both, well, I don't know if the throat shot could have been fatal, but he appeared to still be alive. So the driver, William Grimm, pulled the limousine to a left and to a halt to make sure he'd be killed. Three shots were fired with the only unsilenced weapon, a Mannlicher Carcano from the Dal Tex, from the broom closet window of a uranium mining company that was a CIA asset by an anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Nestor Tony Escadro, and where the Mannlicher Carcano is so unreliable that it was apparently the first shot that missed and hit the curbing and injured James Tague, then the second missed and hit the chrome strip above the windshield, and the third then, after the limousine was brought to a halt, hit Jack on the back of the head. Now, he had this spinal pain and injury from World War II, PT-106, and he was wearing a very tightly wrapped corset to help him maintain, you know, his momentum with less pain, but made him immobile. He couldn't duck. After he was hit in the back of the head, he leaned he fell forward, and Jackie eased him back up, was looking him right in the face when he was hit the right temple by a bullet that blew his brains out the back of his head, and he slumped to the left. There's much more to the story. Let me encourage everyone. I'm putting it out on my BitChute channel, my interview with Joaquin Hagopian of this morning. But also you want to check out my JFK special from 18 November, which you'll also find on my BitChute channel, which I dedicated to Oliver Stone in anticipation of what was forthcoming, his new film, Inside JFK, which was really a disappointment because he revealed no new information, nothing we didn't already know by 1980, and which was mostly devoted to the magic bullet, not even knowing its origin, with Sam Kinney. So thank you all for being here today. Sorry it's been a bit chaotic, but that's the way it can be with live radio. Have a great weekend. Spend as much time as you can with your family and friends. Be well.
This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle, live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, the Perfect Triangle with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict.